230345. So council may approach the appropriate tables when you're ready. Reconstituted the panel, Judges Smith and Frisch join me, Judge Slater, in this matter. As council are aware, we, each party will be allowed 15 minutes, 5 minutes additional for appellant. We do ask that when you begin your comments, that you identify yourself, your name, and who you're representing. There's a button on the podium, as you may know as well, to adjust it if you need to an appropriate height. And the clock, of course, is noted there too. We ask that you pay attention to that. And so council for appellant, when you're ready, you may approach the podium, and when you begin, state your name, and then you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, council. My name is Brooke Baskell-Warg, and I represent appellant mother S.A.N. in this appeal of the order terminating her parental rights to her two children. Reasonable efforts are a critical element in child protection matters. They are so important that the failure of the agency to make reasonable efforts can defeat a termination of parental rights. One essential component of reasonable efforts is the case plan. The provision of reasonable efforts and the development of the case plan are two statutory requirements that this court has tied together. They are also tied together by the plain language of the statutes. The requirements for the case plan, including the content, how and when it is to be developed, and the procedure for court approval, are plainly outlined in both rule and statute. Importantly, whether a parent complies with the case plan is tied directly to the statutory grounds for termination. There are two primary issues in this appeal. First is whether the district court erroneously determined that the department made reasonable efforts, given the department's failure to comply with the statutory and rule-based mandates regarding the case plan. Second is whether the district court abused its discretion when it concluded that the statutory grounds for termination were met, given the lack of reasonable efforts and reliance on mother's noncompliance with the voluntary interim case plan.
Council, can I just clarify, maybe as to both issues, but I heard from both, the focus really is reasonable effort, so you're not separately, your client doesn't separately contest the statutory bases that the court found, but for the fact of your main argument that the statutory requirements of the case plan have not all been followed, therefore the efforts made were not reasonable, hence that would not be a basis also for statutory basis under the statute.
Sure, I believe I followed you, Your Honor.
Yeah, I repeated myself a few times while I was asking it, so I'm glad you could interpret.
The argument essentially with the statutory bases is that it was an error for the court to rely both on the fact that mother did not comply with what was only a voluntary case plan that was never approved and ordered by the court, and also that it substantially relied on that noncompliance, given that in each of those statutory grounds, the court could consider, or at least in two of the three, could consider, and it's explicitly named in there, whether the reasonable efforts have failed to correct the conditions leading to the out-of-home placement.
So a follow-up question to that, just also for clarification or my edification. Your client does not contest the court's finding as to what the efforts that were presented and testified to by the county. Instead, the abuse of discretion is the conclusion that a case plan had, a written case plan had been properly implemented. You see my, the distinction, because the court made a number of findings of the efforts that were made with regard to chemical dependency, mental illness, the cell phone, transportation, the sort of things we normally see, and whether efforts were reasonable to fit the specific issues related to the out-of-home of the children, placement out-of-home. And so, but your focus is not those facts. It's the implementation of the case plan.
That's correct, yes. So the actual reasonable efforts that the court found were made in terms of you know, providing cards and payment to the parents, or you know, making calls to them and staying in contact with them. That is not at issue. What is at issue is the actual case plan, whether there actually was a case plan here. And I'd assert that there wasn't, given that there was one never filed into the record. And so Your Honor is absolutely right. There is a distinction there. The focus in this appeal is whether reasonable efforts are made when there is a lack of a case plan in a case.
The state references exhibits 3 and 7 that were admitted at trial. Do you want to comment on those documents?
Sure, yes. Those documents were admitted into trial. As I noted in my brief, there is no filing stamp on those documents. There is no record of them being in the court file. I would also note that those documents...
They're in the court file because they're exhibits 3 and 7.
So correct.
They're part of the file. You know, I understand the arguments that there's no paper trail, essentially. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the way that, you know, a different characterization of your argument. There's no paper trail showing that it was filed previously. Is there some requirement under the statute that a file stamp has to be on the documents? I mean, or any of these other components need to be part of the record?
Sure. The statute does require that the case plan is filed. And of course, for the court to actually approve of that case plan, it needs to be filed into the record. For the court to have oversight of that, the document needs to be filed into the record. I would also argue that submitting a document at a TPR trial that has already commenced, that was supposed to be provided to the court and to the parent 30 days after the case commenced, it is not appropriate under the circumstances, given the importance of the case plan and the role that it plays in the case.
Refresh my recollection. Was there an objection to either of those documents as they were admitted at trial?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't believe that there was.
And there's not a claim that the substance of the, if we call Exhibits 3 and Exhibit 7 potentially a case plan, there's not a claim that mom was unaware of what the substance of those documents provided.
So the, you know, at trial, mom did testify that she was generally aware of sort of the expectations. I would note that the court entirely discredited mother's testimony in its order. So to the extent that we can rely on that, I'm not really sure. But I do not directly make the claim here that mother was not aware of what was in the case plan. I would also note that in ARB, which is a precedential decision of this court, that that this court rejected the argument that it's harmless error for a case plan not to exist or not to be filed into the record when a parent, simply because a parent knows what is expected of them. That was flatly rejected in that case, and I believe it should be here as well.
But wasn't the point in ARB is because the father who was in prison, the court was convinced by his rebuttal to that is, how would I know what to do if I haven't been told what to do? And so that, as I understand or reading that case, that seems the big distinction here is, you just admitted your client knew what she needed to do.
Well, the client testified that she knew what she needed to do at trial, and sure,
the
court
made findings consistent with that part. I know, I understand your point. Didn't find your client credible, but the social worker also talked to it. We shared this. We gave her the pretrial hearing report that also had a section of the case plan, and it never changed other than it was updated after each hearing, and that she was given that as well.
Sure, and I would argue that ARB did reject that line of argument in that case, though the facts are slightly different. And I would argue that it still applies here. I would also note that the case plan, and I explore this a little bit further in my brief, is not simply a to-do list for the parent. It is entirely a two-way street for both the parents and the department. It outlines, yes, what the parents need to do based off of the issues that brought the case into court, but it also outlines what the agency is going to do and the changes that they need to see in order for a successful reunification. So it really is a a document, not only for the benefit of the parent, but also for the benefit of the court who is overseeing the agency's implementation of the reasonable efforts. That could not have happened here because there was not a case plan filed into the record.
So, counsel, when I look at the district court's order, and it's talking about the case plan on page 11, paragraph 24.0 of the order, identifying the elements of it. And if you look at the end of the first paragraph, it says, see exhibits 114, 102, 105, 109, 111, 115. Speak to those, please, if you would, and why those are not case plans. I think they were, I don't know, I'd have to scroll up and I won't. But they might have been the, you know, sort of the periodic reports. And why those don't qualify as a case plan because they were not, you know, separately, like on the register as such, or are they is that the problem? Are they substantively insufficient based on the contents of them? What precisely are the arguments about why the district court citation to those don't satisfy the requirement of a case plan?
Yes, Your Honor, it is noteworthy that the court does not actually rely on the two exhibits that purport to be case plans that were used in this case. They do primarily focus, and I believe most of these are on the pre-hearing reports that were submitted to the court throughout the case. I would argue that they are substantively insufficient. They don't have all of the required elements of a case plan that are clearly outlined in statute.
If they were sufficient substantively, would you have a problem identifying those as a written case plan, although they are not, like, they don't appear in the registry of action as such? I'm trying to figure out where the problem lies precisely.
Sure, yeah. The PHR functions differently, in Hennepin County, we refer to them as PHRs, pre-hearing reports. They function differently than a case plan. The case plan is the overarching goal of the entire case. The pre-hearing reports are meant to give periodic updates on what is happening in the case, whether the parent maybe has made sufficient progress on an element of a case plan, whether there are other issues that are coming up. They are not the same as a case plan. Were they to contain all the elements required in a case plan, perhaps that would be different, but that is not the case here. They do not. They simply outline, you know, updates on the case, the to-do list for the parent, and some updates on whether the parent has progressed on any of those issues.
Okay, so a case plan that was substantively sufficient, even if it weren't separately filed, if it were incorporated in a periodic, the pre-hearing report, or PHRs, is that what you referred to? That would not be a substantive problem then for reasonable efforts. It's really seems to be more that the contents of what the description of the case plan, because I don't know that these reports differ from what, from the case plans at Exhibit 7 and 3, if those were the numbers that, you know, you don't, or the district court did not rely on. If it really just comes down to a matter of what is contained in them. I mean, it seems like it outlined them again in these reports.
I think ultimately we need to have before the court something that outlines what is, or that follows what is required by statute and rule to be in a case plan. There are a number of things that need to be included in that case plan, including, what led to the out-of-home placement, the concerns that the department has, about returning the children home, the things that the parent needs to work on and the changes the department needs to see. It also needs to outline the services that the department is going to provide to the family to ensure reunification. It needs to have a statement about whether the department jointly prepared or attempted to jointly prepare that case plan with the parent, which is also a requirement under the statute. There are a number of things that need to be detailed in that case plan, and the PHRs here are simply not sufficient to meet that requirement. I hope that answers your question, Your Honor.
I mean, when I'm reading the briefs, it's more about, it seems to me, let's focus on ARB and let's say, there wasn't a case plan filed, end of story, they're important, it wasn't filed here, And that therefore establishes that reasonable efforts weren't provided. But it sort of seems more like the argument here is about it doesn't matter whether it was separately filed or not. What was the case plan? The asserted case plan is itself insufficient. Seems to be more what the focus is of this.
Yeah, I would agree, Your Honor. It's not, I think the department characterizes them as technical deficiencies, but if we look at the case as a whole where there is no case plan available in the record that provides an opportunity for court oversight, that really is a substantive issue that goes to the heart of the case and the reasonable efforts. It's the plan for the entire case. It's how we are going to get this family reunified. Without that, there cannot be said to have been reasonable efforts by the department.
And the reasonable efforts, just structurally for me, the reasonable efforts statute that you're referring to, sort of the top line, there are no reasonable efforts required, they aren't made, and then we tie in the, as you talk about the other problems like the form, et cetera, and not just form, but, you know, whether the parent was consulted, et cetera. What is the statute for that you're referring to for the reasonable efforts?
For reasonable efforts, that's 260C.012.
Okay.
And there have been some changes that now require, and I believe it's under Section H, that now require that mirror the requirements for the case plan, which is that the services need to be selected in collaboration with the family. So those are even more strongly tied together now. And Your Honor, I see my time has ended, so I will address any other questions on rebuttal. Thank you.
Very well, and you will have rebuttal, of course. Counsel for respondent, you may ready approach the podium, identify yourself, and then you may proceed.
Good morning to Your Honors and Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Britta Nicholson, and I'm an Assistant Hennepin County Attorney. I'm appearing on behalf of Hennepin County Child Protection, which I will refer to as the department throughout the argument this morning. I wanted to begin my remarks by flagging for the Court two recent Court of Appeals opinions that were published in June of this year that squarely address some of the issues that are raised on this appeal as well. The first one is the matter of the welfare of the child of JLG. That's number A23-0168. And that addresses both the joint preparation argument and also the compliance with a voluntary case plan argument. In JLG, the court found that the county satisfied the joint preparation requirement for the case plan when the social worker tried to discuss the case plan with appellant, but the appellant refused. The court concluded that the county did attempt to involve the appellant in preparing the case plan in satisfaction of the statutory requirement. And that logic directly applies to this case. In her brief, appellant argues that the department failed to jointly develop a case plan with appellant in our case. However, the record is replete with examples of the department attempting to engage the appellant in the development of her case plan, including within that 30-day time window while the case plan is statutorily required to be developed in conjunction with the parent, and the appellant flatly refused those efforts. Either she didn't respond to emails, she didn't show up to in-person meetings, or when she did connect with the department, she told them, "I don't need a case plan, I don't need to do any services because I don't have any issues."
Counsel, the department. On that point, it's a fairly glaring omission that we don't have case plans filed in the traditional sense of just being filed, and then the two that we do have, as counsel for appellant pointed out, out-of-home placement plans have nobody's signatures. You've kind of answered why mother's signature is on there, but my practice or my experience as a trial judge is that when those situations were the case where a parent was not cooperating, there would still be a social worker signature, a guardian ad litem signature, maybe some other members who took part in the decision making that was leading to the plan. And I didn't see anything on the record as an explanation. What's with this blank, no signatures, that sort of a thing? Is there something in the record that I missed that kind of explains that? Or is it simply mother didn't cooperate, but no explanation as to what the rest of the people did, or as it related specifically to the case plan, as opposed to didn't cooperate and giving us her cell phone number and didn't get to treatment?
So the lack of the department or the guardian signing the case plan was not raised at the trial. It was not addressed in the record, and it's not a statutory requirement for a case plan and is not, in fact, a reflection of whether or not reasonable efforts were made. And it is my personal experience in working with the department that often those case plans are signed by everybody when they're able to convene an in-person meeting with the parent. So everybody is in the same room, they're able to review the document together, and then everybody signs it. The department made multiple efforts, as outlined in my brief, to set up those face-to-face meetings, but either appellant wouldn't respond to the emails to set up those meetings, or when they were scheduled, she wouldn't show up. Or there were even a couple of examples where the department was able to get the father to engage, and he reported, the mother was aware of this meeting, I told her we were meeting with the social workers, and she said she didn't want to come. So the department should not be faulted for the fact that the appellant in this case wasn't willing to attend those meetings to give everybody an opportunity to sign the actual document.
There's and a number of documents that we're referencing in the files, right? So we've got Exhibits 3 and 7, and Judge Smith indicated there's a number of documents that are referenced by the district court on page 11 of the district court's order. What is the document that you're claiming are the case plans?
So often when we use the phrase case plan, I believe what's being referred to is the formal written case plan under Minnesota Statute 260C.212. That's the written out-of-home placement plan, and that is Exhibits 3 and 7.
All right. But the phrase... What do we make counsel's argument that those documents don't appear in the record separately as a case plan? They are only introduced at trial. There's no file stamp. There's no other indicia that would normally be attached to those documents that would communicate to the world that this is the case plan that has mom's buy-in, that the social worker has approved, that the court is expecting everybody to follow.
So appellant's main argument was that there is no file stamp on the out-of-home placement plan. However, that is not, the analysis is whether there was prejudice from that. And the fact that it was never actually filed is not grounds for a reversal of the termination. And as the case law I've cited in my brief, which states that there has to be some type of prejudice from that. The key inquiry is whether or not the parent knew what was expected of them in order to be reunified with their children. And in this case, the record is abundantly clear. She knew exactly what she needed to do. One of the salient facts is that she had just successfully completed the same case plan, which was court-approved, court-ordered, in her prior child protection case, which had closed only 4 months before this new child protection case opening. And it was the same issues in both cases, methamphetamine use and mental health issues that led to neglect and abuse of the children. It opens up 4 months later, she has identical issues, is given an identical case plan, and she knew exactly what she needed to do because she had done it just 4 months ago. So the procedural fact that it was not actually file stamped is not fatal to a termination of parental rights. And that argument is specifically addressed on pages 33 to 35 of my brief, and it was squarely addressed in the MSH case, which is A14-0415, that was issued in August of 2014. And in that case, the appellant made an identical argument that there's a lack of reasonable efforts because the statutorily drafted out-of-home placement plan was never file-stamped into the record. And the court found that there was no prejudice demonstrated from that because the appellant knew what he needed to do. He just chose not to do it. So therefore, the termination was affirmed. And it's my position that analysis applies here and the same result should be reached in this case.
Counsel, in those two documents, those exhibits that were not, or those case plans that were not filed, is the substance of those case plans incorporated in the later exhibits on which the district court relied?
The substance of those written out-of-home placement plans are mirrored and echoed in various other documents that are in the court file. For example, as you were mentioning earlier, Your Honor, the pre-hearing reports explicitly outline the elements of the case plan for the mother and her compliance, and also the department's lack of compliance, and also the department's efforts to assist her and their obligations and their efforts to assist her. In addition, the beginning of every pre-hearing report has a narrative section that outlines the reasons why the case opened in the first place. There's also a section called a harm and danger statement, which explains why the facts that led to the case opening are child protection issues and what the parent needs to correct in order to be reunified with the children. Those pre-hearing reports were updated and periodically filed and served upon counsel for the appellant. So that is one way that the out-of-home placement plans were reflected in filed documents. In addition, as I pointed out, the termination of parental rights petition, which was filed in June of 2022, clearly outlines every element of the appellant's case plan. There's also a section outlining how the department has made reasonable efforts, and that document was served, personally served, on appellant, and she acknowledged in her testimony that she was aware of the elements of her case plan and she received paperwork about it. So that was another document that reflected the written out-of-home placement plan. So the department did meet the statutory obligation to develop the formal written out-of-home placement plan. I think appellant is trying to make this case seem more like ARB, in which there was completely no case plan developed whatsoever at any point. But that completely overlooks the fact that the department in this case did develop the document, Exhibits 3 and 7. They wrote the document they were required to write. And the fact that it was not substantively filed and file stamped does not change the analysis here, because the analysis has to be, was there prejudice to the appellant from the fact that this document wasn't file stamped? And at the end of the day, there was not.
I'm sorry, but I mean, for ARB, there is an initial order that describes some after an emergency protective order. That describes some initial, it's referred to as the initial order, right? Which I'm sure happened here too, right? And then we concluded that there was nothing following that created a case plan. And I think the argument here is same here. Like, what can you point to that shows the case plan that's different from, you know, an initial order, that's we're in the same situation here? And I think the key is like the timeliness too of the person receiving the case plan, that they know what to do, not that they find out about it later, but that, or you know, not that there's evidence that she received it later, mom, but also that she had it in a timely fashion. So it seems like the reliance is on the case plans that were not filed, but is there a finding by today an argument, but is there a finding by the district court that the case plans that weren't filed or evidence that we should be looking at were in fact provided to mom in a timely fashion so she could take the steps needed, even assuming it's, you know, a complete enough one, which I know is also at issue?
So I'll begin by addressing the ARB distinction, because I do believe there is a very stark distinction there. The initial case plan that they referred to in ARB was very bare bones. It basically said establish paternity and cooperate with the department. So as the father looking at that wasn't able to say, oh, here are the steps I need to take. If I check these boxes, that will work me towards reunification with my child. That was the issue there, was that it was substantively inadequate, and that didn't have any of the information that is required by 260C.212. In stark contrast, in this case, starting with even the first EPC order from that hearing, which also lists the court's findings about the issues that led to the out-of-home placement, why the child can't be in the home, that EPC order contains documentation of the court-approved case plan, which listed very specific elements: complete a Rule 25, drop random UAs, complete a mental health assessment, attend supervised visitation with the children. And appellant knew that those were the specific steps, and yet she chose to do none of those things. And in this case, there was a specific finding in the court's termination order that, contrary to the mother's assertion, the department made reasonable efforts to engage mother in the development of her case plan and in the services of her case plan. And under that finding, there are two pages of citations with an extremely clear timeline of every date that the department tried to meet with the appellant and inform her of her case plan. And even in that first 30-day time window from April and May of 2022, the department was specifically discussing with her, as documented in the worker's case notes and in emails between appellant and the worker, even in that first month, the department was talking to her about the specific elements of her case plan. And for every one of them, they told her, for example, she was on the UA color code green. They gave her resources for where to complete a Rule 25. They told her the need for therapy and explained why it was important. And for every one of those issues, appellant's response was, well, I don't have that issue. Specifically, I don't use drugs anymore. I don't have mental health issues anymore, and therapy didn't work for me in the first case. So they were discussing in detail each and every one of her issues and each and every element of her case plan. This isn't a case where appellant was confused and didn't know what she needed to do. She's not saying she didn't have guidance or she didn't have support. This is a case where she didn't do her case plan because she didn't think she had issues, she didn't want to, and she felt like she didn't need to. Even if those exhibits 3 and 7 had been file stamped in the court record, that would not have changed this appellant's behaviors at all. Even if they were file stamped, she still would have said, I don't need to do anything, I don't have any mental health issues, I don't have any chemical dependency issues, and she would not have engaged in her case plan. There is simply no grounds in this case to say that if that case plan had been file stamped, that mother would have complied with her case plan and she would have been reunified with her children. That is just simply not the case here. And in her reply brief, appellant attempts to argue that the harmless error standard shouldn't apply here. However, the case law is replete with examples of the fact that in juvenile protection proceedings, and specifically with terminations of parental rights, they will not be overturned in the absence of prejudice. They will not be overturned for harmless error. And for example, even one of the cases that appellant relies on in her brief, which is a published case from 2022, the matter of the welfare of the child of ADB, 970 Northwest 2nd, 725, has the direct quote, we reverse only where there is no harmless error, and it's citing the DJN case. And that standard was reaffirmed recently, albeit in an unpublished opinion, but in the welfare of the child of DRL that was just issued this June, A22-1815. And the plain language of that says, instead of requiring strict compliance with Section 260C.212, we have emphasized the circumstances of each case and the nature of the county's noncompliance in the context of how and whether the county's conduct prejudiced the parent or otherwise constituted something more than harmless error. And that case is also extremely relevant for having language that states on page 8 that neither this court nor the Minnesota Supreme Court has adopted a rule requiring strict compliance with Section 260C.212 in order to satisfy the statutory obligation to provide reasonable efforts. We decline to do so here, observing that such a rule would conflict with previous decisions in which we have upheld determination of reasonable efforts despite similar deficiencies and failures to strictly comply with 260C.212. And what the appellant, I see I'm out of time. So
if you want to do a closing statement, you can do that.
I would just ask the district court's order be affirmed. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. And counsel for appellant, you will now have 5 minutes rebuttal.
Your Honors, I'd like to address just a couple points from respondents' argument. The first is the reliance on JLG, which is a recent opinion, as well as DRL. Those are both non-precedential cases. I would note in that DRL that a case plan was filed in that case, which is different than what occurred here. In JLG also, I would distinguish in that there is no evidence here that joint development of the case plan ever occurred. Sure, there are references in the SSIS notes and in the court's order saying that the department made attempts to contact mother about her case plan or discuss the case plan with mother. There is no evidence that there was ever an attempt to make to jointly develop that case plan with mother. Informing mother of her case plan, asking mother to engage in her case plan are not efforts to jointly develop that case plan with the parent. I would also note that it is concerning that the department caseworker in this case did testify that generally the department does not jointly develop those case plans with parents. This is, it seems, a practice in Hennepin County and potentially elsewhere that is problematic given that it is a requirement under the law to jointly prepare a case plan with a parent. And of course, that joint development is important because the case plan also needs to explain which services the parent and the family requested. That is not documented here. There is some testimony, at the trial that mother, talked about domestic violence issues and things of that nature. But there is a specific case plan component that is required, and that is what services did the family ask for. I would also, spend just a brief moment on the argument that the TPR petition is sufficient to notify a parent of what is expected of them. That generally comes late in the stage. Of course, in this case, it was slightly different given the timelines. But to say that a TPR petition is sufficient to inform a parent of their case plan generally is not sufficient. I would also note that on the issue of prejudice, as explained in my reply brief, yes, this court has generally applied a harmless error standard, or you need to provide a showing of prejudice in TPR cases. I would note that many of those cases rely on general civil case law, which does have a rule, Rule 61, that requires a harmless error analysis when statutes or rules are not followed. The rules of civil procedure do not apply in child protection cases, and there is no similar rule in child protection under the rules of juvenile protection procedure that mirror Rule 61. So whether the harmless error standard can apply in a TPR case, I think, is debatable here.
But you don't dispute, and the case law that respondent points to referred to some of the cases as well. Either our court or the Supreme Court has repeatedly referenced deficiencies alone are not a basis in the case plan as long as the overriding purposes are met.
And I wouldn't.
So how do you square that, whether we call it harmless error or deficiencies that's not a basis to reverse alone? I assume it's in a backdoor way of getting to, well, what's really missing here? What's the harm?
Mm-hmm. So I would first argue that many of the cases that respondent relies on are non-precedential cases from this court, many of which, if not just about all of which, predate the ARB decision. I would also argue that in this case where there is a lack of a statutory case plan period, that is different, where perhaps there are other excusing factors. I believe in RMM, you know, the court decided it wasn't an error because mother was, I believe in that one, transitory. There were all sorts of other issues. She said she would relinquish her parental rights, that she had abandoned the children, et cetera. And so those types of factors are not present in this case. So I do believe it is distinguishable factually and because we don't have the substance of a case plan in this case. And, Your Honor, I see my time is almost out, so I would just close by asking this court to reverse the termination of parental rights order and remand to the district court so that the department can complete a case plan and allow mother time to finish it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, both counsel. We appreciate your comments and answers to our questions today and the briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement in the expedited method, 45 days for TPR case. Have a good day.